The work of this church in the world is realized through the generous financial support of all who call this place home. Along with the gifts and time and talent, ours is a shared ministry. You have a role to play here. Church membership is open to all. For more information, go to uusf.org.
As a nominating committee, we are charged with equipping and recruiting people for leadership at UUSF. And for 8 years, I did this work in the broader world as the chief programs officer at Coro, a leadership development nonprofit, working with thousands of leaders across sectors. Leadership in religious communities can look different. The value-centered aspects, the moral, ethical, and relational accountability are often more explicit. And yet, in many ways, it mirrors leadership everywhere. Throughout my career, I have been asked to define leadership, what it looks like, how it shows up, and how it shapes us when we step into new roles. And over time, one truth has crystallized for me. Leadership is fundamentally about owning your agency. It is about recognizing your power to act on the world from wherever you are. Leadership is seeing that everyone has a role, finding yours and saying, to quote the Bible, "Here I am." We asked members of our congregation to reflect on where they lead and what they have learned by playing their part. My deepest thanks to Adam, Erica, and Bruce for sharing. You are in for a treat.
I moved to San Francisco in June 2023. Having lived all my life in New Jersey, my home state, where I went to school, where all my friends and family members were, I did not know a single person in San Francisco or elsewhere in the Bay Area, for that matter, upon moving here. I was alone, but I knew the best way to make new friends was to put myself out there. I may have left my home state, but my passions and identities remained with me. Growing up as both gay and queer in a Syrian Circassian Islamic household, I found comfort in both poetry and spoken word. To paint vivid imagery using my pen as the brush, to normalize queer love, and to call action against injustice. Back home in Jersey, my friends and I would perform at open mics in Montclair and Newark. So when I moved to the Bay, I would later seek a religious community that would make space for all who I was and came here. But immediately, I knew the best direction to go to find community would be an open mic. I began looking for open mics in the city, and with luck, I found this recurring open mic called Vocal AF. The next event was happening in July, 1 month after moving to the city. It was happening at an artist and event space called, in the Castro, called Queer Arts Featured, the former home of Harvey Milk, his campaign headquarters, and camera shop. Upon entering the space, I was amazed and awestruck. What struck me the most, though, was seeing the person who had become my first friend in the city, who is also my dear mentor and affectionately in our culture, my loving aunt and uncle, Amo Orchato. Mama Ghanoush is their name, a talented, fabulous, most kind and principled Palestinian drag queen, artist, and activist. Along with her husband, Zach, another talented and treasured friend as well, they hosted monthly open mics at this queer and trans haven. And that night, and for almost every other following month since, I performed both my poetry and spoken word. I sang of high praise for the fog city, battle cries of liberation and hope in tough times, my own intersectional identities, and lastly, lines of rhyme for the men I loved with dazzling big eyes. What went from flying into the Bay alone to now being nestled in a community. I was so devoted to Vocal AF that both Mama Ghanoush and Zach asked me to help take the lead and co-host the event series in 2025. I was beyond stunned and thankful that they asked me, and with enthusiasm I said yes, to host performance events at a space that I view as sacred to the queer and trans community was an immense honor. There was a joy in leading an art event, centered on talented voices that I don't get to share as often. I take pride in creating a space that people feel comfortable enough to consistently return to. Once a month, I get to lead a space where those who attend are like lighthouses, providing a beacon of hope to weary travelers, creating a safe harbor where other travelers can anchor themselves and build a stronger port together to weather a storm, a community. There is power in being a captain in a safe harbor. Being welcomed and converted to the power of all this, it was compelling and joyful to agree to do my part in it.
In addition to being a member of this congregation, I wear other hats. Mom to Isabel, who is now a barista on Sunday mornings and who will be graduating from high school this spring, and to Hannah, who will be moving on to high school next fall. Wife to Andy, who was raised Jewish and agreed that our girls would also be raised UU. And daughter to John and Gwen Burens, whom many of you probably know. Dad was senior minister here recently, Mom is a retired Episcopal priest, and I quite literally grew up in several churches, including All Souls in New York, where Vanessa and I helped run the Sunday school together for a while. The professional hat I wear is as president and CEO of the California Association of Public Hospitals and Health Systems, or CAPH. You're probably familiar with San Francisco General Hospital. In fact, there are 16 similar hospital systems across California that are there for you if you are on Medi-Cal, or are undocumented, or are having a psychotic break, or get into a car accident, or need regular primary care, whatever is needed. These systems are the ultimate backstop of our healthcare delivery system, yet even in the best of times are often the most taken for granted and neglected, even in a state as progressive as ours. Needless to say, 2025 was the worst year in my 21 years at CAPH. Although we thought we were prepared for a difficult year ahead, none of us could have predicted the intensity, magnitude, or unprecedented nature of so many actions. DOGE, $1 billion worth of cuts from Medicaid, threats to gender-affirming care, ICE raids. It all took a brutal toll on the doctors, nurses, and other providers, but most importantly, on the patients that public hospitals are committed to serving. Every day, the leaders of public hospitals had to dig deep, demonstrate resilience, and find creative ways to assure patients that they were indeed safe. They had to pivot from initial plans to expand certain projects to shelving them, then contemplate how to scale back existing services. It was a disappointing, disorienting, and demoralizing year. My role was to advise, support, and console the leaders of these hospital systems and to fight in the trenches for these vital and powerful health institutions that were and remain under siege. Speaking to them last month, I offered three pieces of advice, which I will now offer to you as a community with shared values. First, I reminded them of the privilege of our mission. We are so lucky to do meaningful, purposeful work on behalf of those who need us. Challenging times for people working in social justice are clarifying and unifying. Second, the power of keeping a long-term perspective in this moment and remembering that progress is rarely linear. There's an old Jewish teaching that says, "It is not your duty to finish the work, but neither are you at liberty to neglect it." Even though we won't likely be around to witness true equity, access, and quality, we must continue to work towards it, doing the best we can with what we've got, and trust that the work will be taken up by other people after we're gone. Finally, I reminded them, and I remind you, of the power of joy. Some might think it's counterintuitive or maybe even selfish to be joyful when people's access to basic services or their fundamental safety is being threatened. But joy can actually be a healthy response to challenging times. As the poet Audre Lorde said, "The sharing of joy, whether physical, emotional, psychic, or intellectual, forms a bridge between the sharers. We will only get through this time by building bridges, and we must do so joyfully." That evening at the conference, we had dinner and then danced, laughing together the next morning as we gave out Golden Dance Shoe Awards for the most inspiring moves on the dance floor the night before. So here is to more joyful, purposeful, ongoing work out in the world and within this community. We will continue to get through it, make a difference, and spark joy.
When I think of significant leaders, names like Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, and Mao Zedong, and Mohandas Gandhi come to mind, and rightly so. They were leaders who made a tremendous difference in a positive way in human affairs, and they exhibited qualities that I believe are essential to worthy leaders. First and foremost, such leaders exhibited a belief in humanity, combined with outrage at injustice endured by their communities and beyond. Leaders recognize that oppression is not the inevitable consequence of human frailties, but of governing systems that can be changed, like Jim Crow racism, white supremacy, colonialism, capitalism, imperialism. A good leader challenges the status quo despite the odds against them and evident dangers. They manifest a confidence in the people and a firmness in principle while being flexible in tactics, an eye fixed on strategic goals while learning along the way. Good leaders recognize that open exchanges of views are essential for pursuing the truth, an indispensable necessity in the quest of human liberation. Effective leaders do not promote or seek revenge, but rather transformation. While there are no perfect leaders, and those mentioned here had weaknesses, they made positive, world-changing contributions to the cause of social progress. And if in the end, as always, much more remains to be done. However, much of the significance of these leaders lies in the movements they spearheaded. History, human history, has been shaped and reshaped by massive movements when ordinary people step forward as leaders at various levels to challenge oppressive systems. We need not go back in history to see this. A movement against fascism is unfolding before us as we speak. In communities across this country, emerging leaders are stitching together grassroots networks to stand with immigrant day laborers on corners, Home Depots, and neighborhoods, challenging ICE invaders with whistles, bullhorns, and cell phones. Street monitors in cars, bicycles, and on foot serve as early warning systems around schools, government buildings, and small businesses. They accompany immigrants to court, hold vigils at detention centers and courthouses. They distribute food and accompany adults to work and children to school. Their numbers are growing. When Trump threatened to send ICE and the National Guard to the Bay Area, one network grew from a few dozen to 700 overnight. 5,000 attended a Zoom training on a few days' notice. I have witnessed these leaders coming forward, and what stands out to me is how many of them are women, including very young women. There's a recognition that a bedrock of fascism is to devalue women's worth, abilities, and right to choose. New York Times columnist Michelle Goldberg pointed out, "Now we are seeing an outpouring of misogynist rage. We see retribution for courageous resistance in the cold-blooded murder of Renee Nicole Good. As popular resistance has spread, fascists in their desperation resort to intimidation through escalating violence. A mark of leadership in this moment is to inspire defiance, recognizing that the power of an awakened, determined populace can defeat an oppressor." In witnessing these ordinary people stepping up to do extraordinary things, instilled with a confidence in humanity and a determination to bring down an unjust system, it gives me hope in these times of trouble. To all who are stepping forward in these times to become leaders in this emerging movement, please know that you have our deepest thanks and respect. History may not name you, but humanity will honor your collective effort, your splendid diversity, and your commitment to put minds and bodies to the task. Courageously persisting in the pursuit of love and justice shows us there is a pathway to defeat fascism and forge something better in this world. And what could be more beautiful?
Life in these United States has been rough on our spirits and our institutions. Can I get an amen?
Amen.
But even in this disaster of a reality show, these last 2 or 3 weeks have been especially heartbreaking. Can I get an amen? In this time, we have declared war by another name, so without democratic assent, and with only thinly veiled economic purposes behind a spit polish of moral rhetoric, all of which you might say has become the norm. Can I get an amen?
Amen.
Honesty and transparency went out with the trash yet again when a new website came up about the insurrection of January 6th, now retold, I am told, as a fairy tale of courage and patriotism. Can I get an amen? And meanwhile, stormtroopers in winter masks, ramming cars, breaking windows, dragging bodies from their homes, pepper spraying nonviolent protesters, maiming bodies, and then rewriting even what is evident from body cam footage, if they agree to provide it, has become the norm of the evening news and front pages. I never liked to use the word evil very much. It felt like theological and linguistic nuclear bomb, and I didn't want to diminish the power of that word with casual overuse, like a few other words in our vocabulary. It was something that the wise saved up for when the impact of using it mattered, for it to land as it should. In this moment, in these moments, in these weeks, I hope you agree there have been a number of times when the word applies that what is happening is evil. As Mark mentioned, the call went out on Friday for clergy to show up in Minneapolis, reinforcements to witness and match the reinforcements of soldiers armed and uniformed as Immigration and Homeland Security. Homeland Security, ironically, the created to protect us against terrorists, now agents of terror. Our reinforcements will be unpaid. No fat bonuses to sign up, no guns, I hope. I don't have one to bring. We go hoping to not, as Shakespeare once wrote, prick the conscience of a king, because we have no hope of that. But of the nation, for sure, of its moral majority in the largest, I hope and pray, sense of who we are among us. To wake up again to what our ancestors, some still alive, who walked through the civil rights movement, had to stand up and prick the conscience of a nation and wake us up to again and again, as we do again and again through our history. To this vision, my fellow brothers and sisters, and if not citizens of this nation, at least residents in it, to the story, as flawed and winding and sometimes painful it has been as it played itself out, this story that held us up to what our national symbols try to remind us, a place where the Statue of Liberty still stands, still with the words of Emma Lazarus, thank goodness, to welcome people to our harbors, and a golden gate welcomes others with all the promises. And yes, we believe in justice, but also mercy and a balance of powers. In this nation that risked long ago declaring its right to be free of the vagaries and abuses of unchecked monarchies, having lived too much under their thumb. And we have a sermon today planned to talk about leadership. Appropriate? Absolutely. And as a pastor, I just want a name maybe a little hard to focus some Sundays. So, I invite you to take a breath. Listen if you can. Zone out if you need to take care of yourself. Just promise maybe you'll go back and watch the recording. To be awake to the world as the Buddha commanded so centrally we tried to, is to be awake to all the brokenness and how that can feel, as well as to its beauty and invitations. And to be awake then in some moments is potentially to feel overwhelmed by what we awake ourselves to. And I wonder if we don't feel overwhelmed sometimes when we face all of it, stand in front of it, because we can't see a way out. And I wonder if we can't see a way out sometimes because we have this false myth about leadership that misleads us when we face such moments, one that's far too narrow. You and I both know that some of the people that Bruce named at the very beginning of his reflection weren't the whole story of how change happened, right? As he points out later in his reflection. We all know, as fabulous as Rosa Parks was as a human being and a leader, she didn't launch the civil rights movement, right? She was already part of it, trained and training others in its ways. And Ruby Bridges, oh my goodness, as sweet and steely strong and beautiful a young girl as she was, she didn't integrate the Louisiana schools all by herself. And Lincoln didn't free the slaves all by himself. Change happens, as Bruce mentioned, when movements arise that are like complicated, interdependent, highly functioning ecosystems that are the engines of what mobilizes vision with back office support and logistics and creative engagement of the community and so much else that makes it happen. Deepa Iyer, in her book, Social Change Now, a book that's the common read for Unitarian Universalists. We have one every year. We try to read it, all of us around the country. In it, she lays out this schema that tries to identify the myriad of key roles that are needed to create and sustain these ecosystems of change. If you look in your order of worship, if you haven't already, you can see under sort of the events of the day, this image, it looks like a wheel with values in the center and then spokes coming out of it. It's reproduced with her express permission. She gives express permission in her book that you can reproduce it. And I want to walk through it, just touch on it quickly. So you can see the roles that she identifies as pieces of what an ecosystem of change is. And then I want to talk about why I'm walking through this. Some of those roles are obvious. You won't be surprised to see one listed as the visionary, right? Visionaries are these I have a dream vision casters, very appropriate to name on this particular weekend, and with the music and the celebrations we have of Martin Luther King Jr., who absolutely was one of them. You have a sense through history, we all do, of what they can do. They rally people to a literal picture often of what they're doing and why and how it all pulls together to a destiny and a destination that they keep us focused on. But look at the other roles. Did you think that each successful movement needs at least one storyteller? The person who weaves a narration of words, but also potentially of art or dance or music or social media posts to tell the story of the work as it's going on to the larger world that invites them to see and participate in it? Or what about the disruptors? We like those in Unitarian Universalism. Can I get an amen, right? They are often the ones who absolutely are not bystanders, let's be clear. They're out in front speaking truth to power in ways that are challenging and that trigger change. You can think of Greta Thunberg. There are also the frontline responders. They are those often at the demonstrations calling the shots, directing volunteers in the middle of the crisis. They're like often ER attending physicians when something goes wrong in the city, cool heads thinking in a crisis. I'm sure we'll meet some of them in Minneapolis next week. Often also at the front lines and close by, but less often named and very, very important, no less important, are the caretakers. Those are the people who tend to the well-being of everyone who's in the work, maybe offering a shoulder to cry, but also, have you ever wondered who fed all the people on the march to Selma? Who drove them to and from the various locations? Who made sure they had a place to sleep at night and walked around checking in with people? This is a highly intuitive and relational and caring group of people. Another role, separate but related, are the healers. These are the folks who hold space for the larger hurt that often comes with people to the work. Maybe it's what draws them to the work. It can also be some of the hurt and trauma that is part of what people meet in the work. These are the people who look ways to find opportunities for accountability and repair. Think about that. Who work during and after to try and find ways to turn pain and grief, wherever possible, into wisdom and larger strength, like the alchemy of the work afterwards. Think of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of South Africa, the healers. There are the builders. These are the folks who put actionable steps and spreadsheets and resource organizing behind the plans, make the plans behind the visions. You might say these are the people who take the lofty visions that people dream up and actually put foundations under them. Related are the experimenters, who think of new and novel solutions to problems, novel implementation, innovative ways to invite people to do the work that might have greater effect. There are the weavers in this work, people whose role it is to see the connections of ideas between movements and groups and constituency and facilitate conversations and build shared strategy and deepened coalitions in the work. Finally, there are the guides, those who take their knowledge and experience about any of this work and impart it to those just entering into the social change ecosystems of the world, people trying to find their place in it, or who found their place and need help knowing how to do that thing well. You can read more about each of these roles in Deepa's book. It's fantastic. And she has many, many questions for reflecting on each of the roles. But what I want you all to hear, if you haven't already, is all the different roles we can play in making change possible. And I hope you hear also the invitation, the possibility that we can alternate roles in our lives, play one at one time, choose to enter into another, see our gifts and possibilities actually more perfectly expressed in another. But in all of it, when we feel, if we ever do, find ourselves stuck in overwhelm, on the sidelines, wringing our hands, as a friend said to me this week right before she booked her ticket to Minneapolis. that when everything seems so huge, maybe this schema with all its invitations can help. That as Courtney said, and I hope you'll take away, leadership at its core, as she's come to believe in her work, actually as a guide, that would be one of those roles, and probably storyteller in your work, is to see that we have agency and then to decide how we want to express and take that agency seriously, choose our place. So maybe your place is storytelling in the form of a letter to the editor or a guerrilla art exhibit on lampposts in the city. Or maybe it's a meal taken to protesters, as some folks here brought meals to the student protesters who were doing a sit-in for peace a couple years ago to the students at University of San Francisco. Or maybe it's offering to do the volunteer follow-up emails for the winter shelter. Hannah would love to talk to you after service if you're interested in that. Or maybe you feel qualified to create a quiet space to gather and light candles and hold the reality of what could not be changed when the work is done. And I want to thank our speakers for sharing all their different snapshots of their dialogue with where you have chosen just one piece of the many pieces that you have chosen to exercise your leadership and what you've discovered in that journey, and to give us a sense of the different ways leadership shows up, even in our own community. Invitation to find more of those stories among us. There is an ancient interpretation of an old and familiar story. It says that when Eve grabbed and shared that apple in the Garden of Eden, it was a deliberate act. That she and Adam saw the need to leave any protective garden and claim their own agency as moral adults, and ever after making it their job and all their descendants to be held responsible for shaping the world. No matter what the origin story is, this is our inheritance. Dorothy Day, remarkable woman and Catholic organizer and activist, once wrote, "People say, what's the sense of our small effort? They cannot see that we must lay one brick at a time, take one step at a time. A pebble cast into a pond causes ripples that spread in all directions. Each one of our thoughts, our words, our deeds is like that. No one has the right to sit down and feel hopeless. There's too much work to do." So may we go forth in the face of everything, as hard and complicated and painful as it plays out each week. And even if we feel unworthy or overwhelmed, may we continue to challenge ourselves to find and claim one place, our place in the ecosystem of change right now. There are lots of possibilities, and it takes all of the roles to make the wheels of change happen. And there's not a moment to lose. May our efforts be met with wild success for love's sake. Amen.